Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Israel has abandoned the ceasefire agreement and restarted its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza, a war that has destroyed the region and killed tens of thousands of human beings. The ceasefire, as Gaza-based writer Hassan Abu Khamar, among others, reminds us, still allowed Israel to deprive Palestinians in Gaza of food, water, medical care, education, and freedom of movement. But it wasn't enough. And as Belen Fernandez writes for Fair.org, Israel's U.S.-endorsed resumption of its all-out genocide killed at least 404 Palestinians right off the bat. But it was reported in, for instance, the New York Times as Israel tries to pressure Hamas to free more hostages. We know that elite media will tell us someday that the whole world was horrified by the genocide of Palestinians, and that journalists decried it. But someday is not today. We need reporters who aren't not afraid that they will be targeted, but who may be afraid and are nevertheless bearing witness. Reporters like Hassam Shabbat, 23-year-old Palestinian correspondent for Al Jazeera and Drop Site News. He was targeted and killed March 24th, and he wasn't even the first Israeli journalist assassination for the day. Hours earlier, Palestine Today reporter Mohammed Mansour was killed in an Israeli strike on his home in southern Gaza. The genocide of Palestinians is a human rights emergency, and it's also a journalism emergency. U.S. reporters who don't treat it as such are showing their allegiance to something other than journalism. And a key part of their disservice is their ignoring, obscuring, marginalizing, demeaning, and endangering the many, many people who are standing up and speaking out. Pretending protest isn't happening is aiding and abetting the work of the silencers. It's telling lies about who we are and what we can do. We build action by telling the stories powerful media don't want told. We'll talk about that today with reporter Michael Aria, U.S. correspondent for Mondo Weiss and the force behind their new feature called Power and Pushback. That's coming up, but first, Trump issued an executive order titled Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government. While you might imagine that any feminist, gender-oriented, queer, scientific, reality-based organization would throw such a hateful directive in the trash, alas, no. As we learn from Mira Lazine, reporting for Aaron in the Morning, herself citing independent reporter Mady Castigan, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network removed all mentions of LGBTQ folks from their website. And the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children announced plans to do the same. Aaron Reed notes that the Boys and Girls Club of America removed pages referencing gender identity or trans issues. A transgender girl story was removed from an article about relatable youth experiences. Domestic violence support group Futures Without Violence removed all LGBTQ-related resources on its online store, along with the Victim Rights Law Center. Okay, but media. Aaron Reed also reports how the New York Times got up in its feelings in an editorial condemning Trump's shameful campaign against transgender Americans. Why, they hate it, you understand? They frankly hate it. Except that the paper platformed Pamela Paul, who stated openly that being transgender is a choice and a dangerous and bad one. The Times, like other outlets, want to have their cake and eat it too. to say trans people deserve rights, by golly, don't you know? But folks who say they don't need rights also need to be respectfully heard. And media scholar, activist, FAIR supporter, and board member Bob McChesney passed away March 24th. For years, I've said if Bob McChesney didn't exist, we would have to invent him, because he built the bridge from an old, intentionally obfuscatory style of media criticism to an active, human-centered one. He said, journalism isn't a respectable fly under a microscope, but a vital function in a society with democratic aspirations. And he laid out the underexplored history that illustrates that idea. He said systemic structural change was needed, while other chin strokers were saying audiences were sufficiently empowered by their ability to rewind the videotape. He was forthright and avuncular and kind and an inspiration to pretty much anyone you hear today talking about the impact of corporate control of journalism and why you should resist it as part of any other social justice work you do, and how we actually have a long and true history of doing just that. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Listeners may have heard about the violent attack by Israeli settlers on Hamdan Balal, who had recently won an Academy Award for the documentary No Other Land. He has since been released from Israeli detention, but that doesn't erase or obscure the fact that he was assaulted, arrested, and spirited away in an overt attack on free expression and truth-telling. As his co-director told AP, quote, "We came back from the Oscars and every day there is an attack on us. This might be their revenge on us for making the movie. It feels like punishment," close quote. Listeners may not have heard of all the non-Oscar winning people who have been swept off the street and disappeared for voicing any concern about the Palestinian people, who are victims of what the majority of the world outside these borders are calling genocide. Into the current context comes Power and Pushback, a new feature at Mondo Weiss, written by our guest. Michael Aria is Mondo Weiss's U.S. correspondent and author of the book Medium Blue, The Politics of MSNBC. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Michael Aria.
Thank you for having me.
Mondo Weiss has been reporting, calling attention to, critiquing the occupation, ethnic cleansing, genocide of Palestinians, and the U.S. role there, and U.S. news media's distorted narrative for some time now. And yet there are still so many fronts to this fight. There is still so much that calls for resistance that you saw a place for a new intervention, this new focused feature. Tell us what you're trying to do with Power and Pushback.
I think the idea behind Power and Pushback is we're in a situation, as you describe, where there's so much happening, and this can often be a challenge, I think, for any media, let alone independent media, to keep up with. We have very small staff. Obviously, we don't have the capacity that mainstream outlets do. And with so much happening on the domestic front, especially over the last few weeks, but really dating back to the immediate aftermath of October 7th when we saw the kind of student protests begin, I think there was a need to kind of develop another place to kind of catch stuff before it fell through the cracks, mm-hmm. so to speak. So the idea behind Power and Pushback is to put a focus on repression that we've seen throughout the United States regarding or targeting the U.S.-Palestine movement, but also to talk about some of these local fights and local battles that not just students, but people in their communities or in their workplaces are kind of waging on behalf of Palestine. And the idea is to really center that and focus on that and just put a spotlight on these fights and show people that they're not alone, that people are fighting. There's victories throughout certain states. we didn't want it to be just kind of like, this is the suppression report and this is all terrible things that are being done. We wanted it to have both elements, which is the idea kind of behind the title. We want to cover the power centers. We want to cover lawmakers pushing draconian policies and pro-Israel groups moving to target Palestine protesters. And we wanted to cover, obviously, these terrible unconstitutional moves by the Trump administration. But we also wanted to show the resistance that's developing domestically against those policies and the people who are pushing for that.
It seems so important on many levels. First of all, if folks think there's no pushback or resistance happening, that shapes their understanding of what's going on. But also, one person speaking out is easier to suppress, and they need to be backed and supported by a community and by other people. So it's not just, here's a cool story about somebody resisting this. It seems to me to give meaningful support to the individuals who are putting themselves on the line.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think something we should keep in mind, one of the objectives of these kind of moves that we've seen in recent weeks from the Trump administration is to obviously crack down on dissent. And part of that is to make people fearful about fighting back for fear that they might be scooped up by ICE if they're not a citizen, or their student organization might be suspended from the given college or university. So really, throughout American history, whenever we've seen these kind of campaigns, they really purposely have this chilling effect on the population, and that's kind of the idea. So as you say, we're kind of also developing the newsletter with this in mind, to show people that it's not just one person or two people, it's thousands of people who oppose these policies and are trying to fight back in the face of this, despite these attempts by lawmakers and pro-Israel groups to really chill the environment and make people skeptical about standing up and voicing support for Gaza.
Particularly at a time when it used to be, well, write your congressperson, you're upset about something. And we see the frustration with that avenue. And lots of folks will say, we'll go out in the street, we'll protest. Right. And so then you have to ask, okay, what's the follow-up to that? When people do protest and they are harmed for that, you can't simply say, we all ought to be out in the street, and then not care about what happens to people who go out in the street, is my feeling.
Absolutely true. And to your point, I think this time around with Trump, we have seen a slightly different approach from the liberal establishment. I think they've been much more kind of willing to go along with his plans and much more complicit. We see the anger towards politicians like Chuck Schumer for approving the Trump budget. But I think that focusing on the liberal establishment and their reaction tends to get people maybe to look at the situation the wrong way. I think there actually has been a lot of protest. The numbers indicate there's been consistent protest. And there's also been a lot of attempts to challenge the Trump administration legally. So Just Security runs a tracker. This is just in my head because I just wrote a piece where I referenced it. But I think there's 146 current lawsuits or kind of legal challenges attempting to stop the Trump administration when it comes to many issues across the country. But more than a few of those lawsuits are connected to our issue, the issue of Israel, Palestine, and student protests. So like you say, people want to do something, but they feel goes beyond just sending a letter or just calling and leaving a message for their congressperson, especially because it's worth pointing out what we've seen for the last 3 weeks has really been a culmination of a push that we've seen from years,
right,
in terms of stifling pro-Palestine sentiment and in terms of stifling criticism of Israel. And that's really been a bipartisan project, even though Trump is amplifying it now and increasing it and has taken it to these draconian levels. We've really seen both sides of the aisle embrace some of these policies that he is currently kind of amplifying.
Absolutely. Well, I was, along with many, struck by the statement of Columbia Journalism School Dean Jelani Cobb to students after they'd been told to scrub their social media, to essentially kind of thought cleanse evidence of concern for Palestinians or protest against U.S. actions. And this is in the context of the ICE arrest and whisking away of Mahmoud Khalil. And Cobb said, quote, "Nobody can protect you. These are dangerous times," close quote. He's speaking to future journalists, you know.
Yeah.
What is the lesson there? What else might he have said?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'd say he said that in response to another professor making a comment, basically telling students not to post about the Middle East conflict on their social media page. I think we're really at a interesting and scary time when we look at universities and colleges in this country, just the overall state of higher education. I think that just like I was talking about before, how the stifling of pro-Palestine sentiment is not a new issue. It's really been, you know, it's the culmination of something that's been happening for years. We can say the same things about our university system, right? I mean, over the last 40 years, 50 years, maybe even, we've seen this real push to really push kind of neoliberal policies across higher education to kind of move to a donor model, as opposed to a model where these schools are kind of set up and live up to the grandiose words of their mission statements.
Right.
This idea that they're these places that kids can go and learn about freedom of speech and have the freedom of inquiry and learn about how society works and how the world works. After October 7th, we saw some big time pro-Israel donors kind of threaten to take away money to schools or actually do it. I think the schools are really between a rock and a hard place because they don't want to see their endowment threatened. And recent decades, we've seen that that is kind of the important thing. An institution like Columbia is a private university. They're not really beholden to the First Amendment technically in the way that other places throughout the country are. And first of all, we should say the Trump administration first canceled about $400 million worth of contracts and grants to the school.
Right.
For what it said was their kind of inability to crack down on anti-Semitism. I mean, we know that they're referring to the fact that there were pro-Palestine protests on campus. This had very little to do with anti-Semitism. We know that they're being targeted because they were the first school to erect a Gaza encampment last spring, which kicked off a wave of protests throughout the United States, obviously across college campuses. We know why they're being targeted. But I think the very scary thing here is they withheld that money and then they sent Columbia a letter kind of detailing things that Columbia could do in order for them to revisit that issue, essentially implying that maybe you could get the $400 million if you did the following things. And those things include like instituting a mask ban, suspending a number of students who were connected to an occupation of Hamilton Hall on campus last spring. They wanted new protocol in terms of disciplinary actions. They wanted someone to oversee the Middle East Studies Department, among other things. And almost immediately, Columbia complied to all these demands. They've said publicly that they were actually thinking about doing some of the stuff before Trump had asked them. I don't know if that makes it better or worse.
Right.
But that's a huge part of the story. We've seen the universities in this country really power and just respond to the Trump administration and do pretty much everything they've asked for in this regard. And shortly before Mahmoud Khalil was detained on March 8th by plainclothes ICE agents, despite the fact he's a permanent resident with a green card, Columbia had actually changed their protocol when it came to its status as a sanctuary campus. Sanctuary campus, essentially the same as a sanctuary state. They had previously said that they wouldn't comply or assist ICE if they were on campus. And days before Khalil was detained by ICE agents, they sent an email out to faculty and students and staff saying, we've modified these policies. There are some situations we're going to let ICE on campus without a warrant in certain circumstances. So that's a huge part of the story here. I just think that the university's kind of going along and being complicit in this entire ordeal. And we've seen a lot of resistance from faculty and Columbia students and students across the country who are really kind of protesting not just these policies that we've seen from Trump and lawmakers, but also the complicity of their schools.
Gosh, there's so much to say and to respond to, but along with, in particular, the Columbia protest, you see the erasure of Jewish people, of anti-Semitism being used as a cover to punish and penalize a community that is composed in large part by Jewish people who are protesting the actions of the state of Israel. And the idea, you know, Trump, of course, being Trump, just says, if Chuck Schumer opposes my policy, he's a Palestinian. Like, that's, you know, he's in his own world. But we are seeing other institutions essentially say, Jewish people, you're not Jewish if you are critical of Israel. That seems like another shadow horror that is happening and that media are playing a role in.
It's a very dark irony to your point. I mean, not only have there been vast protests by Jewish activists and Jewish students, we saw Trump Tower occupied in the wake of Khalil's arrest. The fact that the Trump administration is citing anti-Semitism as their reason for detaining these people, essentially, I think when Khalil was first detained, there was maybe a belief that the Trump administration was going to rely on some war on terror policy or maybe something from Bill Clinton's anti-terrorism law from 1995. But what we saw is that they're actually relying on an immigration bill from 1952, which was introduced at the height of the Red Scare. And that bill was introduced and wielded as a way to target actually survivors of the Holocaust, Jewish refugees in the United States who conservative lawmakers had targeted because they accused them of being Soviet agents. So the irony here is that we see this law that was used to target Jewish people in the United States now used allegedly to protect them. And it is another dark irony, I think, that it's coming from this administration of all administrations. I mean, as you said, Trump casually will criticize Chuck Schumer by claiming he's not Jewish, calling him a Palestinian. Trump has repeatedly kind of criticized Jewish people more broadly for not voting for him, questioning whether Jewish voters are even Jewish because he did all the stuff for Israel. Inherent there is kind of the conflation of Zionism and Judaism, which in itself I think is anti-Semitic. But it goes without saying that you don't have to travel very far down Trump land to start seeing examples of people that have been accused of anti-Semitism in his administration. We're dealing with multiple people, either directly in his administration or kind of in that broader world, who have literally given Nazi salutes in recent weeks. So there is a real, like I said, irony to this whole situation that's very disturbing, where you have this administration who clearly anti-immigrant, bigoted history in anti-Semitism in many areas, and they are detaining people for defending Gaza, for fighting against genocide, and claiming that they're doing it because they're anti-Semitic, and that that anti-Semitism somehow threatens American foreign policy interests. So we're really in a dark, upside-down time, I think, and it's very terrifying.
Looking at what we know about media, we know that years from now, they will tell us, remember when we were all out in the streets protesting Israeli genocide in Gaza? We know that they will say that, you know, Martin Luther King would have said, you know, they will co-opt the powers that be, including in corporate news media, will co-opt the actions of today. Columbia University will have a photo montage about the protesters and how they allowed protests to happen. I mean, we know how history can be rewritten in real time by news media. You know, it's so frustrating to look at it today and know the way that these folks are going to try to claim ownership of protest later. That's not a question. It's just a rant. But we can see it. We can see the way that they will talk about, oh, the civil rights movement, that was good protest.
Right.
This is bad protest. When in real time, they hated the civil rights movement.
It's very true. And, you know, these images and videos people probably seen yesterday, a tremendously disturbing video coming out of Somerville, Massachusetts, Rameza Öztürk, who's a 30-year-old Turkish national and doctoral student at Tufts, was detained, right, much like Khalil, snatched up on the street by undercover ICE agents wearing masks, where the police took her phone away from her. And it's not hyperbole to say these people are being disappeared in broad daylight. And to your point, I think people love to look back on history and convince themselves they would have been on the right side. They like to watch movies and, you know, about historical time periods and think that they would have been siding with the right side. But I think the way that people are reacting to this now, if they are supporting it or ignoring it, I think it's pretty clear what side of history they would have been on if they had lived through something like the Holocaust or like the civil rights movement. And also, to your point, there is no kind of accountability for the media whatsoever. Where this is just an aside, but in the last couple of days, we've seen this big controversy over the Signal chat, obviously, where the bombing of Yemen was kind of revealed to a reporter. I mean, that reporter is Jeffrey Goldberg, a former IDF soldier who's obviously has contacts throughout prominent politicians in the United States, but he's also somebody who helped push a fabricated story about Iraq's alleged connection to al-Qaeda, which over 20 years ago, that helped pave the way for the Iraq war.
Right.
And the media is just kind of filled with reporters like that who have faced no accountability, who have actually moved up in their careers and have more power now than they did 20, 23 years ago. So it just speaks to your point, what will things look like a couple decades from now? I think all the people who are maybe ignoring this or cheering it on or not responding to it in any kind of serious way will probably not have to face any type of consequences. And to your point, they'll also be kind of controlling the narrative in terms of how this period gets remembered.
Yeah, you can always fail upward in news media. I'll just ask you finally for any thoughts about Power and Pushback, what you hope folks will take from it, what you hope to uplift. Any final thoughts on this intervention that you're spearheading?
I would encourage people, if they're interested in this subject, to go on our site where they can subscribe to Power and Pushback. We're really hoping, beyond this being a kind of way to highlight the fights that I'm talking about, that it also kind of opens up a dialogue, that people feel if they're working in their community in terms of something, or they see something where free speech is being stifled, that they can reach out to us and we can potentially, you know, shine a light on it and cover it. Sometimes this stuff doesn't happen where it's a lot of news cameras. Sometimes it's not 1,000 people. Sometimes it's just as simple as somebody being told they can't wear a certain pin to work, or their website faces some sort of crackdown, or their student group at a small college is suddenly suspended. So we really are focused on covering this kind of big picture Trump stuff and this big picture higher education stuff, but we really hope that it also becomes kind of a forum for these smaller scale battles, because I think these are really going to add up. And polling shows us that things have really shifted. Like, Israel's brand has really diminished over the past decade, particularly among progressives and Democratic voters, even if party leaders and Democratic lawmakers haven't caught up to that. So I think in some capacity, the momentum is on the side of the people who are protesting on behalf of Palestine, even though when you look at the media, it seems to be the opposite. I think that a lot of these draconian measures are obviously a response to those successes. Mm-hmm. We've seen this crackdown on the BDS movement. We've seen this push to adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which equates some criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. So I really think, insofar as Trump represents a backlash politics, and he does in many capacities, it's also a backlash to the advances the Palestine movement in the United States has made over the last few years. So, like I said, in addition to covering the repression and suppression, we really want it to be a place that kind of takes a close look at that progress and looks at this in a wider way where people can turn and you can talk to us about that. So that's kind of what we're hoping. So I encourage people to check out our site where they can read about this stuff pretty consistently, but also sign up for our newsletter so they can get that information.
We've been speaking with Michael Aria. He is U.S. correspondent at Mondo Weiss. That's mondoweiss.net, and author of their new feature, Power and Pushback. Michael Aria, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.